session to discuss operationalizing safety. And our first presenter is Eileen Frazier. Welcome, Eileen.
Okay. And I'm going to talk about what Air Medical can teach us. I'm going to go through five different parts: policies and practices, learning from our mistakes, fatigue mitigation, safety management systems, and AMRAAM. You might know it as CRM. Policies and practices. Securing ourselves, our patients, and our equipment. About 7 years ago, I spoke to an ambulance association group and suggested that they really need to pay more attention to wearing their seatbelts in the back of the ambulance, and I was almost laughed out of the room. I think it's gotten a little bit better among the ground personnel. Some are shaking their heads here. What we do see sometimes is the air crew is so fastidious about this that when they do transfer a patient and go on a ground ambulance, sometimes they forget to put seatbelts on. It's like, oh, we're on the ground now. I guess I don't have to do this. So I think that's coming along quite a bit. I put this slide in here because we talked a lot about engineering design specifications for ground ambulances. And if you look at the little bit of space in this helicopter, isn't it amazing that we can get all the equipment we need in this small space, but when you go to a ground ambulance, you need a huge box to put all the same equipment and same people. But anyway, this air ambulance, the FAA has a procedure for anything that's hard mounted into a helicopter or an airplane must go through engineering designs, and it's called an STC, so you cannot use that as an ambulance until all of that has been seen and approved by the FAA engineers, and you must have a certificate for that. The reason and that includes a stretcher system that locks into a stretcher loading system. The stretcher here, if you look, you'll see two orange cross securing belts there, and then there's one sort of across the knees or the hips. With our particular standards, we require that they have three cross straps on these stretchers. And many times the manufacturer of the stretchers come through with just two. The reason we require three is because chest, hips, and knees. You'd want to make sure that patients aren't going to get loose or kick, hurt themselves or the crew while we're in transit. And some of the stretcher manufacturers get a little upset because their STC stretchers have only allowance for two straps, not three. So we will have to add a strap in some cases. But it's very specific. You'll see the mount here for the monitor and so forth. That's all been designed so that there is place for emergency egress. Everything is weighed and balanced so that you cannot move anything once it's in there. Bringing stuff onto the aircraft, you also have to weigh and balance, but that's done by the pilot for weight and balance before we ever take off. So those are some of the differences. So what do we've learned from our mistakes with air medical accidents? And oh, look at this. We know how many accidents we have, and we even know the probable cause for each accident. Here's where the statistics really come in handy. 70-80% of our accidents in the air are caused by human error. The most common factors are weather and dark night conditions. VMC and IMC, 74% resulted in fatalities. Visual meteorologic conditions into IMC. According to the IHST, 54% of EMX accidents occur at night, even though nighttime flights account for only 35% of the total flights. So nighttime accidents are more likely to be fatal. Air ambulance accidents that occurred at night were almost four times more likely to result in fatalities than those occurring during the day, said Dr. Villette. So in 2009, we had a terrible year in 2008. So the NTSB really looked at the accidents. And in 2000, we had hearings, a week of hearings at the NTSB. They came up with some recommendations in 2009. Adopt a System Safety Culture, SMS. This can be related also to ground. Use of IFR and HTOS and night vision goggles, I don't think so. But a procedure-weighted risk avoidance program, we can adapt to ground as well. Review weather minimums and improve education on weather, communications, and dispatchers. Some of the overlooked factors that apply both to air and ground is what I want to talk about. We've addressed the level of experience, training, and technology, but we haven't addressed sleep deprivation in assessing our risk to specific to EMS. When the NTSB gets a 72-hour history of the pilot prior to an accident, he often doesn't detail in that report how much sleep the pilot actually had. He might get a report in the report, was he on duty, was he not on duty? That doesn't tell us anything. In one of the most recent fatal accidents, the pilot came to work on night duty at 7 p.m., he had his first call at 9. He came back, had a second call at 11, and crashed. When they were at the memorial service, the operator of this particular aircraft found out that the grandson stood up and said, "You know, Grandpa was really wonderful. He helped me put a swimming pool together that day." So he was up all day in the hot Texas sun, putting a swimming pool together, and then went to work that night. This is not uncommon. 24/7 operations. In 1995, the NTSB found that across all the transportation modes, approximately 30% of the accidents are fatigue-related. Night shift workers are already at a higher risk for injury and errors. In a 2005 study, found that workers in a series of night shifts generally sleep poorly with each successive night shift. Worked by the fourth night, their risk is 36% above the first night. And then what we have is EMS pilots' work schedules are usually 7 successive nights in a row, followed by 7 off, then 7 days in a row. And we find many EMT drivers and paramedic ground crews are working more than one job and are going from one job to another without any breaks at all. I think, and we think, fatigue is a very serious issue. We've touched on it a little bit before. And in addition, EMS also has an emergency response expectation. I look back at studies, and the first known study of fatigue associated with accidents was in the 1896 of wagon drivers. And they found that contributing causes to those accidents were economic pressures and societal demands for faster deliveries. Does that sound familiar? So in all studies, fatigue results in slowed reactions, poor judgment, reduced information processing, inability to perform a task at a high sustained level of accuracy or safety. When we look at these two modes of transport, it not only affects the patient care that's being given, and as one safety director pointed out to me, you might kill a patient because you're fatigued. But if a pilot or a driver of an ambulance is so fatigued that they don't really realize what they're doing, they can kill more than 3, 4, 5, depending on what they hit, patients and people in the area. So it's a very serious problem. So what do we do? Fatigue mitigation practices include things like scheduling. Look at the schedules that your people are doing. Pay attention to what other jobs they do. We have a standard that says you cannot come to work unless you've had 8 hours of off-duty rest before you come to your duty time. People will argue and say, well, you can't tell people what to do on their days off or time off. Well, in one particular case, one of our program directors was watching the news at one morning and getting ready for work, and she saw one of her EMTs out there doing extrication on a really bad accident. And she shows up at 7, and so does he. And he's coming in to do a shift for communications, and she sent him home because they had the rule that you have to have 8 hours of off-duty time. So you must be prepared. Managers must watch this. Okay, fatigue education and fatigue risk assessment tools are also very, very important. I'm not going to show you this is very busy slide, but it's a ground risk assessment tool that can be used. You can find this on the AIMS website. I also suggest that you add fatigue risk assessment tool to these tools, both for ground and air. The other thing that we teach for air medical is safety management systems. And this can easily be adapted to ground systems, and you can run through this and see. It should be a non-punitive system to report hazards and safety concerns, and I talked about reporting a little bit earlier. A system to track, trend, and mitigate errors. You should have a safety manual and a system to audit and review policies and procedures. And then lastly, air medical resource management, AMRAM. You might call it CRM. But what it is specific to AMRAM, specific to air crews. You can adapt that to ground crews. And it includes things like communication processes, decision-making and behaviors, do briefings, inquiries, crew self-critiques, conflict resolution, team building, and workload management, and situational awareness. So those are some of the things that ground can adapt from air. And in summary, we can learn from each other. Ground and air, we're all moving while caring for patients. Safety vigilance for ground is just as important as it is for air, but we need the data for ground incidents and accidents in one strategic location so we can track, trend, and analyze as we do for air accidents to mitigate the risk and hazards. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eileen. Our next presenter is Dr. C. Carol Cunningham to speak about making it happen.
And a special thanks because she's just worked a string of nights and didn't sleep and came here. So she's not driving.
No, I'm not driving. Okay. Is it clicked in? Clicked off.
It's the right.
Oh, the right one. Okay.
To move it forward.
Okay. Oh, I skipped a couple things. Okay. Good morning, or good afternoon. Although I'm a state medical director, I actually am a practicing emergency physician and spend more time in scrubs and in the back of ambulances, which in a way is good. It kind of keeps my pulse on reality. And what I wanted to talk here for the EMS world, you know, we have a status here that's kind of been stagnant. As we've seen through other talks, the vehicles haven't changed much in design, although we have made some strides in EMS providers' safety with the development of hydraulic stretchers. We've got some enhanced 911 services around the area, and now dispatchers actually have a training program that they can go through, as well as some other devices. We still have some gaps to fill. Providers oftentimes don't get the injury prevention training. They don't get encouraged to implement those. And more importantly, as funding is decreased everywhere, there's a lot less funding for training, especially for some of these adjuncts that would help improve our status. So I thought rather than talk about what the status is, we need to look at really what are the opportunities out there so we can improve things for EMS. We've looked at the vehicles, the unibody designs. There are some things that we can implement today. You know, when someone orders a new squad or revamps a new squad, they can add some of the reflective devices to the vehicle. You know, look at the passenger, actually not only look at what the restraining devices are, but start using them consistently, redesigning storage compartments so that the equipment they carry are not projectiles in a rack, and also looking at some of the design and weight of the equipment. I just came back from a week in Israel in December, and it was amazing how lightweight their monitors are. Why? Because they may have to run into a road that's been blown up, and they have to actually carry things by hand. But those monitors work just as well in the daily situation, and they're very, very lightweight. So if they do come free, they're going to cause less injury. For personnel, there needs to be a consistent standard training for injury prevention. We know that sporadically we've kind of told people ways to stay safe, but have we ever really looked at in any data? How many fire departments or how many EMS agencies have it in their SOPs that you must wear your seatbelt? How many EMS agencies actually look at sleep cycles, as Eileen has mandated, not only for air but also for ground? How many states offer reduced insurance premiums for workman's comp for agencies that have implemented or actually have a structured safety programs? Those are avenues that are, I believe, are untapped to really initiate and kind of fire up some change of a culture of safety within our industry. Recently in Ohio, we did a burden of stroke and a burden of heart disease study where we followed folks from the time of the incident of their disease process, not only through their hospital, but also through their rehab. I think it would be a good idea to start looking at EMS. You know, we look at these accidents, we find out what happened, but when we follow those who are injured, do we really follow them into rehab? Do we really follow them to see how many are able to go back to work, how many go back to homes, how many can return back to their quality of life, and then look at the cost of that. Sleep deprivation is already been mentioned, and then also we also should look at some standard operating procedures. There are some states that don't require driving programs for EMS vehicles, and they certainly have different parameters than driving a regular car. In Ohio, we do have some of those programs going on, but I'm not sure if they're nationwide. Looking at the terrain, the National Association of State EMS Officials has a HITS committee that was involved at looking at some of the issues that happened, particularly out in the rural areas, but they also need to be looked at in the metropolitan areas. What happens if you have a freeway where there's a high accident rate? Does the EMS crew know that? What happens if there's an intersection that has a high mortality rate? Wouldn't it be great to know that in advance, or to have that warning in your GPS system so you know you at least have an awareness of that? You might even be able to avoid those areas in the future if you had that. One of the other things we're looking at is, what are your resources for mutual aid? If there is a mass casualty event on a rural freeway, do you know where your resources are? How long will it take to dispatch them? And how can we get those resources logged into a central repository of information where if you do need that surge capacity, you can get it very quickly? And then also, we mentioned the utilization of alternative vehicles, not only for manpower resources, but also let's look at, again, rough terrain. When I was in Israel, the dispatch center we had multiple motorcycles, not to be the first responders necessarily, but again, so they could get to patients if there was a roadside bomb and the road wasn't safe to drive on anymore. Sometimes using another vehicle is actually the safest thing for the provider. In the world of decreasing funding, we have to look at manpower utilization, and that really starts with dispatch. There are many areas in the country where we do not have formally trained emergency dispatchers. I can think of one region actually close to my home, where the dispatcher is a retired grandma just looking for something fun to do. That may save money in the short run, but not in the long run. If you have well-trained dispatchers, they can kind of designate which resources is most appropriate to be dispatched and the safest way to do that. In a mass casualty event, they are also going to know that law enforcement is going to be involved and have that connection with them and know how to, try and make it safe for everyone. Do you need a paramedic with every run? Sometimes you just need an EMT. Air versus ground transport, and where are the distribution of our air medical services? there's been a lot of studies that show that sometimes the fastest way to get the patient to the right place is actually by ground. If that patient needs a higher level of medical care, critical care ground units are definitely need to be developed, as well as distributed properly, like what's needed in the air medical industry. And lastly, there needs to be some traffic and bystander management so that the trained folks can actually get to the patients in a safe manner, and bystanders can be used or managed in an appropriate way. It's great to have a bystander that you find out is trained in basic patient care. You know, sometimes you can incorporate them into part of your team, but obviously if they're not, then they need to be managed. GPS systems, again, I think there's an avenue where we know if we know where the high-risk areas are on our roadways, those can be incorporated in GPS systems. I would love to have one in mind for my own personal use. You know, if I'm traveling in an area that I'm unfamiliar with at night or during bad weather, it would be great to know where that area is so I would have at least the option of avoiding it. With regionalized systems of emergency care and response, that creates networks, that creates interoperability. It also is going to be fiscally responsible in that we are not duplicating systems. It certainly is, I think it works well with, especially with mass casualty event, but even on an everyday basis. And then there's the use of telemedicine. Does every patient that we see have to be transferred? Not necessarily. If we have telemedicine in our pre-hospital areas, as well as in our interfacility networks, we can, again, gain some cost savings. We can use our EMS resources more wisely. I think oftentimes people forget that every time we call out a helicopter, at least in the greater Cleveland area, you've spent $15,000. It would be great to know that person needed air medical transport and really needed to be transferred and could potentially have been taken care of in a hospital close to them rather than remotely.
So 1 minute, please.
How do we get there? You know, it's through data. Currently, this is our state. EMS, it's an island. Some of the safety measures and data that we collect that we do for commercial truck drivers who are carrying our groceries are often better than what EMS has, and we've got even more valuable cargo in the back, which is someone's life. So I would propose let's try and get rid of the red. You know, right now we're not an island. We need to turn that red to green. And the way we can do that is to, again, formally train our dispatchers, have mandatory use of restraint devices and safety measures for EMS personnel and patient injuries. We need to log the fatalities, find out why they happen. And we also need to start including EMS in our traffic incident management drills and planning. Likewise, on a national level, we're seeing the implementation of the National EMS Education Agenda for the Future, NEMSIS, as well as a recently document that was released by the CDC, Guidelines for Field Triage of Injured Patients. Because if we can get this uniformity, link our data with the pre-hospital crash records and everything else, that will build a great foundation for us. Because through data and through research, we can actually create standards. And it's through standards is where we can improve the safety for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cunningham. We appreciate that. Our final presenter will be Dia Gaynor, speaking about balancing relative benefit in safety initiatives.
Well, this is pretty close to having to bat mop up. but I do facilitate the next session, so I can assure you it will resemble a lightning round. And if I'm going to get put in charge of this, I am from Idaho, so I'm pretty good with anything with a trigger. You know, when Nadine asked me to talk about balancing relative benefit, I really had to stop and think for a while. you know, about what that means and why it matters and how it ties back into the kinds of conversations we've been having here and at prior summits about safety. And I think when the word benefit comes to mind, most of us jump immediately to a combination of words like risk benefit, right, or cost benefit. The organization that I represent is comprised of the states. For those of you who aren't immersed in the EMS industry, very quickly, every state has an emergency medical services office. 80% of them are housed in the State Department of Health, and all but a very, very few have broad regulatory authority over all aspects of EMS systems. So I want you to think about the states, especially in the absence of a congressionally or presidentially declared lead agency for emergency medical services with an appropriately defined scope and resources. We're really left to the machinery of the states to figure out what can and should be done. And really, when we think, and it's great to follow Dr. C, because I think as a state EMS medical director, as she is, as a recovering state EMS director, as I am, we think about resources, you know, first and foremost. So when the topic of safety is on the table, first it's about the resources, not only the safety of those resources, but the safety of those the resources serve. And of course, and this map hopefully is recognizable to some of you now. And Rick Payne, you better get this one right this time. I think it's the third time I've shown it to you. this is the 1 hour map of the United States, and those patients in the purple areas are the ones that are fortunate enough to be within a 1 hour flight time of a trauma center. And the CDC has told us that there's a 25% lower death rate for patients who are taken to a trauma center versus a non-trauma center. So if we want to talk about safety first and foremost in the form of survivability for patients, let alone the safety of the crews caring for those patients, we have to look at resources like this. So how do we close the gap? If, in fact, we end up with, you know, counties or towns with no hospitals or huge expanses of the United States with delay, significantly delayed access to trauma care, then what are the kinds of things that we could think about from a safety standpoint that are aimed at that low ratio of risk to benefit or cost to benefit? And the first thing that came to my mind was public safety answering points. A few times today, Next Generation 911 has been mentioned. That is well underway. We are not talking about Star Trek. And just as quickly as we've seen the availability go up and cost go down of the smartphones we're holding in our hands, we're looking forward to the 911 centers coming along accordingly. And having capabilities of information being moved to and through those public safety answering points, first to protect the emergency response personnel themselves. And that may be, you know, in the form of route selection and guidance or avoidance of hazards or congestion or unexpected obstacles in the roadway, like very large mammals in rural and frontier areas of the country. Or other kinds of mobile applications. If any of you ever see a topic called Crash Help on an agenda, a really cool project being done out of Claremont University and the University of Minnesota, that's a handheld application for use by EMS personnel at motor vehicle crash scenes. But also, in turn, after protecting the EMS personnel, the patient's interests and what it is that we can use today, tomorrow, again, without some significant investment by capturing information that predicts things like injury severity, or more importantly, that transmits information. Linda Dodge from USDOT's ITS Joint Program Office this morning made mention of vehicle-to-vehicle or vehicle-to-infrastructure communications. How about that crashed vehicle alarms me, the EMT or the paramedic, about the biggest hazard in the vehicle to me, whether that's an undeployed airbag or a charged electrical system in a hybrid vehicle and so forth. So how can we move data to and through PSAPs to protect EMS personnel and ultimately enable those personnel to protect their patients? This is from the EMS network that basically runs an RSS feed of EMS-related news throughout the United States. And, you know, blam, six ambulance crashes all posted on one day. I don't know for a fact that all six crashes happened in one day, but this was one day's posting on the EMS network. So what is this? Is this a good day or is this a typical day? You know, we have no idea. Until and unless we reach the point where our knowledge and confidence in the knowledge about EMS-involved vehicle collisions with the same level of certainty as we know about the air medical industry, the same level of certainty as is known about the commercial vehicle industry, the same level of knowledge about the airline industry, the same, until we're there on equal par with those other modes of transportation, I think it's a disservice to EMS. I want to share really quickly, and somehow the resolution on this doesn't look so good on my screen, but hopefully it's visible to you. Because there's no federal repository for data about EMS in general, there certainly is the National EMS Information System about responses, the states are in a position of quantifying everything else. And this is really the bottom line about what's so important about relative benefit. The benefit is there are nearly 19,500 EMS agencies in the United States. There's the benefit. Those are the organizations that stand to improve, first by caring for their own, second by caring for their patients, utilizing over 78,000 vehicles. That is no small army or no small hazard, I dare say, given that number of vehicles that are on the roadways in the United States that we have all acknowledged today, and I heard no one dispute it, are posing a very real hazard to other vehicles on the road. Over 800,000 EMS personnel. That's despite this morning's comment, you know, about the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This does count all the volunteers. That's a lot of people. As far as the span that need to be touched, taught, or otherwise, you know, taken up with the issue of safety as their personal highest priority. And then finally, you know, 37 million EMS responses a year. You know, 76% of which result in the transport of patients. That's 28,000 transportation events. I'm sorry, 28 million transportation events every year. You know, right here that result in patient movement by ground or air. What class of cargo can rival that kind of number with the same level of concern, given that we're talking about humans, not cattle, as Nadine's known to point out, or boxes of commercial goods. So, you know, where do we go from here? Interestingly, I asked the next 10 EMS personnel that I encountered after I took this picture in a small town, I won't reveal what city it was in. And all these EMS personnel were responsible for driving or being, you know, if you will, in the front seat and navigating. And I asked them, did they know whether that arrow on the detour sign meant follow this route to avoid the detour, or did the arrow mean there's a detour ahead of them and they should avoid it? And you know what? Only 3 out of 10 knew the right answer. Now, there's a disconnect between EMS and transportation. All right, so why in the bottom line does this all matter? Only because it yields safe EMS personnel and safe patients? No, we can't stop there. I think the list is longer, and want to cover this with you because it's from a systems standpoint, this is also the bottom line. And that is, first of all, understanding the complete clinical picture of what's happening to EMS personnel if they get exposed to an illness or injured or killed, and understanding the patients for which they care. And for that to be done using EMS, hospital, trauma registry, and other specialty care facility data. Not third-party assessments, not studies of using you know, those we coincidentally run into, but rather good, solid, qualitative methods using this firsthand clinical data. Understanding which patients are transported and more importantly, where and why. Because that too plays in not only to safety, but optimizing patient outcome. I mean, we've got to get to there too, not just a safe operating environment. Evaluation of the quality of care, Looking at trends in medical consequences of crashes and pre-hospital treatment, I mean, really, have we come any further along in our care of patients in what we all accept is the leading cause of death in almost every state for all citizens aged 1 through 44? And whether or not we truly have in not only achieved that safe environment to care for those patients, we'd love to say we'll prevent every crash, but let's get real. Until and unless that happens, making sure that it is the most contemporary and clinically sophisticated care is also a byproduct of assuring safety. Having a complete understanding of patient outcomes, and then obviously performance improvement initiatives, because there's not going to be a point in time where we say, okay, we're done with this safety thing, and move on. There has to be a continuous process that rides along continuously. And then, you know, finally, the relative benefit piece, you know, sort of doubling back around on the data aspect, which we've talked about today in terms of referencing studies here or there, but I think is really the starting point for us to get some solid understanding of what's going on in the field from a safety standpoint and for those incidents that were not successfully prevented from the clinical and EMS response and operations standpoint, we'll only achieve through records linkage, and that would include the crash record, roadway inventory records, and by emergency medical records, I'm being all inclusive there, EMS, hospital discharge, trauma registries, et cetera. Inventories of emergency care elements. I'll show you an EMS incident response readiness, show you a quick picture of what that might look like. And then ultimately, real-time use and short-term retrospective use of device-driven data. And whether that's telematics or other condition reporting systems that can be aggregated at a regional level or at a statewide level, so that within an hour of an unusual series of events or a high frequency of events that are not within normal limits, that can be detected and acted upon. This slide's out of order. I should have had it back up with the public safety answering point in terms of what, and this is an existing resource. That's what I mean about low cost, low risk. We're not talking about inventing something that doesn't exist, that ties telematics service data with the University of Miami algorithm to predict probability of severe injury. So you're the rural EMS crew. You do have the liberty of deciding lights or sirens. You've got a 26-minute response time to that rural scene, and you get told there's a 92% probability of severe injury. Is that lights and sirens decision easy now? Better still, isn't that crew enabled to maybe request other resources, to alert the receiving hospital in that very rural area earlier than they might normally? So this kind of opportunity for benefit is very real and present. And will we not also be, you know, further along the route that when we have data-driven understanding about conditions on roadways, not just, as Dr. C and others mentioned, of I'd like to know as a member of the driving public that I'm coming up upon a hazardous area, don't we owe it to ourselves to identify those hazardous areas, if you will, from an EMS standpoint to include the safety of that EMS system? I mean, that's going to be the starting point for us, because today we cannot draw these colors on a map to say how safe is this stretch of highway, not because of how many crashes happen there, but assuming a crash is going to happen there, how safe is the response and how capable is the EMS and emergency care system in that area? So, you know, take it to benefits squared. Overall, we got to get past the fact that it's not just about safety. It's that safety will yield improvements to EMS overall as a transportation mode, in addition to its clinical capability. We also have to acknowledge that it's beyond the scope of just trauma victims, which I don't think anybody will argue, but that we point out we can also improve care through safe and expedient care for other time-sensitive conditions. Advancements in telemedicine and teletrauma that are possible, that are within, you know, arm's reach, but not yet fully realized. And then cube it all. And that's counterbalancing the rural disparity. I will, you know, go on record that I have a soft place in my heart for rural and frontier areas. But that's really where we've got to overcome the absence of resources. And often it is through not only safety, but data and other resources to counterbalance. So with that, I promised a lightning round. I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you, Dia. So before we start our next session, we do have goodies outside. What we'd like for you to do is to go and grab them and bring them back in here and munch.